Welcome to episode 465 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a compelling, somewhat jocular conversation with educator, fiddle player, chicken coop builder, and our resident historian, Serf William. We will discuss politics, of course, what's going on in Europe. We'll look at it from an historical perspective, and we'll have a few surprises to come your way as well. I think you'll enjoy our conversation with Serf William this go-round. We have an EW essay titled The Magic. We share an excerpt from a short story by Franz Kafka titled Investigations of a Dog. And we have an EW poem called The Manicure. All of this, of course, will be infused and imbued with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to be with you. Let's get to it then. Episode 465 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Happy spring, by the way.
But the wrong yo-yo.
Right train, baby, but the wrong yo-yo. There's no need to hang around my door. I used to love you, but I don't know more. Got the right
train, baby, but the wrong yo-yo.
The magic. She said, "How about you? Anything new and exciting?" He said, "Every time the wind blows." So obnoxious. You are not that important, though each of us thinks so. I am here, therefore I am. The stardust, the morning bird song, the city side glam, suburban strip malls, Tony Soprano, Dizzy Gillespie, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Ruth, Buenos Aires, Paris, Texas, the Colorado River, Golden Pond, Roaring Brook, Mel Brooks, Albert Einstein, Joan Didion, the lady at the bus stop in Columbus, Ohio, who told me I had nice legs back in 1988. The guys dumping the recyclables into their truck. These are my psyche. And you might say, what the? My conscious, though, is informed by my subconscious, I suppose. What does my soul have to do with it? And the chocolate lab we call Katie Girl bites on her lamb-flavored bone as I wonder if the shiny, steady object in the sky above this hillside village is a drone. Perhaps these written pieces have stirred the suspicion of my country's political power. Or maybe it is instead little redhead Fred from down the road, soaring it higher than the county water tower, passing some time as his parents argue about their heavy load, trying to organize, fit in, stay young, not sin, pay the bills, keep the till filled, and try to understand it all from within. The magic, so deep, yet so thin.
A dollar. In fact, no, brother man, here, have two. $2 means a snack for me, but it means a big deal to you. Be strong, serve God only. Know that if you do, beautiful heaven awaits. Asked to pull my rope for the first time. I saw a man with no clothes, no money, no plate, Mr. Wendell. Asked his name. No one ever knew his name, cause he's a no one. Never thought twice about spending on an old bum until I had the chance to really get to know one. Now that I know him, to give him money isn't charity. He gives me some knowledge, I buy him some shoes. And to think blacks spend all their money on big colleges, still most of y'all come out confused. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell. Mr. Wendell has freedom, a free that you and I think is dumb. Free to be without the worries of a quick to diss society, for Mr. Wendell's a bum. His only worries are sickness and an occasional harassment by the police in their chase. Uncivilized, we call him, but I just saw him eat off the food we waste. Civilization, are we really civilized? Yes or no? Who are we to judge when thousands of innocent men could be brutally enslaved or killed over a racist grudge? Mr. Wendell has tried to warn us about our ways, but we don't hear him talk. Is it his fault when we've gone too far? And we got too far, cause of him we walk. Mr. Wendell, a man, a human in flesh, but not by law. I feed you dignity to stand with pride. Realize that all in all, you stand tall. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell. We'll be right back.
Hola.
Surf William, is that you?
You conundrum, is that you?
Ooh, yeah, EW conundrum here from Troubadours and Rock On Tours, your ambassador of all that is irrational and filled with tumult.
Okay, well, from the sublime to the ridiculous.
For those of you who haven't had the distinct pleasure of hearing Surf William on Troubadours and Rock On Tours before, let me tell you a little bit about him. He's a fiddle player, an educator, an axe aficionado, among other things, and most importantly, our resident historian. So, Surf, how's things in Bucks County, PA?
Everything is just peachy here at home. Everyone's doing well. Knock on wood, everyone's healthy and happy. So we're doing well. How are things in Northeastern PA?
Nice. Yeah. You know, enjoying early spring and looking forward to a nice April and so on. So yeah, we're doing fine too.
Nice.
We're fortunate. We're not in the Ukraine, you know?
Which people can say throughout history.
Really?
There have been many times when people have said, thank God we're not in Ukraine.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
Well, yeah, I mean, I mean, you know, just talking about the history of Ukraine and vis-a-vis Russia, it hasn't been pleasant.
Well, you know, that is something interesting to me. I keep hearing the rationale from that horrible man Putin, who says the Ukraine is Russia in many ways. What does he mean by that? Why does he say that? Is there any justification?
Well, they're certainly related. They're certainly cousins, you know, at the most distant, and maybe even siblings at the closest. They have a lot of shared cultural ties, shared linguistic ties. If you look at the history of Ukraine, there's at least, you know, you could go back to like the 9th and 10th century when Kyiv was actually a center of the Orthodox Christian religion, and Moscow was nothing more than a forest. So, you know, if you want to talk about historical context, Ukraine was a highly evolved culture and civilization before there was even a Moscow. So, you know, this idea that, you know, Russia sort of adopted Ukraine is it's a little bit backwards. Again, I'm not like an Eastern European expert, but that much I know. If you look at common sense in history would show you, if you look at, for example, the trade routes in the, let's say, like the early Middle Ages, let's say 900 to like 1200, the Vikings were, the Scandinavian peoples were, as we know, traveling all over the place in all directions from Scandinavia, carrying on trade and some conquest, but mostly they were trading, and what they were doing was following the major waterways from the Baltic Sea and the North Sea, you know, south and west. And if you follow those waterways south, one of the rivers you travel on is the Dnieper River, which runs right through Kyiv. So you can see why Kyiv would have been a major trade center, because if you're traveling from north to south, you're going to travel down the Dnieper River through Kyiv, not through Moscow. You're going to go through Kyiv, and that's going to take you into the Black Sea, which then could take you right to Constantinople really easy.
Mm-hmm.
So you can start to understand why that area that we call Ukraine, why that was a well-populated area, a highly visited area. And then in addition to that, it's got really ridiculously fertile soil. So their ability to produce food has always historically been famous throughout Europe. It was the breadbasket of Europe. So for all those reasons, you know, Ukraine had its own thing going on for centuries. It wasn't until the Bolshevik Revolution that Ukraine was then sort of incorporated into what then became the Soviet Union, and it was the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. And I don't think that it was done with the majority of the population being in favor of that. So, you know, this notion that Ukraine is just sort of a little brother to Russia, geographically, sure, it's smaller. But historically, I don't think that's accurate. I think the Ukrainians have their own culture, their own language, their own history. And it's a little bit of a it's a little bit misguided and a little bit disingenuous to say the things that Putin's been saying about Ukraine, such as they belong to Russia or they're just Russians. That's not really true.
Yeah, I didn't think so. And I appreciate the clarification and the history that you've just shared. You know, when you bring up the things that Putin says to his people in Russia, do you think, based on your understanding, given your you know, studies of Russia, do you think the Russian people, you know, a majority of them are buying into what Putin says, or do you think they're just afraid to contradict what he says?
Well, let me just start by saying this. This would be a good opportunity for you, because I know you have a lot of different guests on your show. So, you know, what a great opportunity for you to find some future guests who could talk in more depth and detail about, you know, cultural life in Russia and political leanings and so forth. No, I mean, I would say what I would say in any culture. There is that segment of the population that supports the leader no matter what. And in Russian culture, you have a tradition of strongmen, you know, like sort of oppressive father figures running the country. And you can just go back throughout history, going back to the czars. You know, in Russia, they have a tradition of strong individual leaders, you know, mandating and dictating policy. You know, they have no tradition of democracy. That basically didn't exist. So to sort of answer your question in a roundabout way, just like in America, there is a segment of the population that are true believers. He is the leader. He's keeping them safe. If he says it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing to do. However, Russia also has a long tradition of political dissidents and people who disagree with leadership. And so I think what you're seeing in Russia now is a high degree of resistance to this absolutely illegal and unnecessary war. And, you know, Putin's responding in a way that all dictators respond. He's squelching the media. He's suppressing dissent at home. He's locking up peaceful protesters, which, by the way, peaceful protest is guaranteed in the Russian Constitution. You're allowed to protest peacefully. But that's been basically, that right's been basically taken away. So, you know, I think there's a huge number of Russians that are absolutely vehemently opposed to this war. I don't know the specific numbers, but I would say in any country that goes to war, especially a war like this, yeah, you're going to have a big part of the population that says, but why are we doing this? Even if that's just the question, why are we doing this? You're not even allowed to ask those questions. In Russia right now, as far as I understand, you're not allowed to call it a war.
No, what is it called? A special operation or something?
Special operation. And, you know, it reminds me of Vietnam or Iraq. You know, you could get me off on a whole tangent now about United States foreign policy and how we've undermined our own credibility and how we have no moral footing here based on our foreign policy over the last 75 years.
What are you, a traitor?
No, I'm not a traitor. As a matter of fact, I'm the opposite of a traitor. I'm a person who so loves his country that he wants to see the policy aligned with the values so that when a leader like Putin does something so egregious and horrible and atrocious, we have the moral authority to stand up and say, you can't do this. We have the moral authority to say, you are a war criminal. How can an American leader possibly call the leader of another country a war criminal when everyone saw what we did in Iraq, for example? In just our, that's just our recent history. You know, we were bombing civilians. We bombed Iraq. We bombed Baghdad. We bombed civilians. We knew we would be killing civilians. And when you talk about a war of choice, a sort of unnecessary war that somebody in a leadership position said, let's do this. Let's give it a shot. Not a war of defense, not a war of survival, not a war, not an existential war, but rather a war simply of choice because you have so much weaponry that you just got to use it somewhere. Hey, look at Iraq. They've got nice targets. Let's bomb them. We just don't have a leg to stand on.
Yeah, you know, you bring up great points. We and we're not honest or even aware of our history in this country all too often.
And that's
the
sad.
General population, yeah.
Because
it
now,
is sad.
Because now we're in a position where we actually could be the voice of decency and morality. We could actually present some moral authority to the world, but we really can't, can we, without being thoroughly hypocritical? And that
hurts. We have to, though. We have to because, I mean, you could also argue every administration's a new one, right? I mean, that doesn't mean the history before that administration, I'm talking executive branch, doesn't matter, and you're not, and we don't have to make amends or take responsibility. Though, you know, this group, maybe they have a better sense of moral authority. Maybe they've learned from what has occurred before them, their predecessors, and they're going to try to do right.
Oh, no doubt. If you're talking about the morality of Biden compared to George W. Bush or Dick Cheney, yeah, I think you could make a decent argument there. My point is simply this. United States foreign policy is United States foreign policy. And to put it lightly, we have a sketchy history when it comes to wars of choice. And when it comes to wars that really border on human rights violations and war crimes.
Yeah, I will not argue with you there. I agree with you. When you just think about the beginnings of this country and how we, you know, what we did to establish this country, atrocities, one after another,
well,
you can pinpoint, you can recognize, you should recognize.
No doubt. And like if somebody wanted to make the argument, hey, look, that was 200 years ago or that was 175 years ago, I would even concede that. I would even say, yes, those were different people in a different time with different objectives. And as horrible as it was, we're not, you know, let's not let that burden our decision making now, right? But
right.
Sadly, it's not ancient history, is it? It's recent
no.
history. You and I are old enough to remember protesting the Iraq War. You know, we knew it was wrong. And here's the thing. I wasn't just protesting the Iraq War because it was wrong in every possible way. I was able, and this is just some, you know, scraggly punk kid, I was able to project into the future and say, if we continue on this path, we will make ourselves completely illegitimate. We will undermine our moral authority in the world. And when the world needs a strong voice for morality and what is right, we won't be able to stand up and do that. And going all the way back to Vietnam, you know, we've consistently undermined our international credibility with our foreign policy decisions, including overthrowing democratically elected leaders in multiple countries. And that hurts me not just because of the action of overthrowing a democratically elected leader, but it hurts me and it hurts the country because in the future, we don't have the moral voice to speak
okay.
up.
Just remind people or point for people to those incidents, or those examples of when we displaced democratically elected leaders and the other, I guess, untoward actions that you just referenced.
Well, forgive me if I don't have the names of all of the leaders we overthrew. But, you know, the things that jump out at me are Pinochet in Chile. We didn't overthrow him. We installed him.
And he was brutal.
And he was brutal. The Batista regime in Cuba was a brutal dictator we propped up until Castro overthrew him. The Iranian leader who was democratically elected and replaced with the Shah of Iran by the United States government and the British Secret Service. Let's see, Honduras. With National Fruit was the corporate interest that persuaded the CIA to go in there and overthrow a democratically elected leader. Nicaragua, we propped up dictators. So again, I could go on and on. You know, there are examples all around the world of the United States government either supporting brutal dictators or actively overthrowing democratically elected leaders to install a dictator who was friendly to our foreign policy.
So right.
You don't have to be, look, you don't have to be an expert in international affairs to just Google it and go read about all of the times the United States government has, in fact, not been on the side of peace and democracy and representation, you know, equal representation, but rather has been on the side of the brutal dictators and not just sort of passively, but very actively. by making sure they stayed in power, by propping them up with military aid and economic aid. And again,
but isn't this just acting on our God-given right at manifest destiny?
Okay, fine. Well, then if you say that, then you're legit, then you are giving credence to what Putin is saying. Because if you say might makes right, then who are we to condemn big Russia for attacking little Ukraine? Because we've already established the fact that might makes right. Forget about what's morally right or ethically right or in the eyes of international law. What we're going to do is we're going to say, if you're the big, strong power, just by the sheer fact that you're stronger, you get to do what you want. Because that's Putin's argument right now.
And well, but Russia, you know, they have to bow down to the United States. So if we don't like what they're doing, they have to listen to us because we are the ultimate. We are the center of all that exists.
Even if that were true, they're not listening. You know, Putin doesn't have to listen to us. Right? And he's not.
Well, we have to get him in line because we're in charge. We are the
right. Now, wouldn't it be great if we had the moral authority to say that? But we don't. Now, don't get me wrong. We should still protest and we should still oppose this war and we should still do everything we can to stop it. All I'm saying is that when you have the history of the United States, you are on shaky ground when you claim moral authority. That's all I'm saying. So, you know, our foreign policy has hurt us in many, many ways, which still have consequences even now when you see the actions of Russia and our inability really to stand up and say, I mean, we're standing up and saying it's wrong, but our inability to really have any true credibility when it comes to the moral high ground.
What would you say to those who would put out in response to what you're sharing that all we're doing is protecting our interests? You know, we're protecting our border security. We're protecting the materials, the resources that we need to sustain our quality of life here in the United States. And when we go to these other countries and do what we do, install certain leaders or what have you.
I would argue that ultimately what you claim to be beneficial to the United States in the long run really hurts us. Because if we really don't stand for democracy and we're installing dictators around the world, that's going to have repercussions for us in the present and in the future. And I would say ultimately it's going to actually undermine our quality of life. And yeah, we might get the natural resources from that country that's ruled by a dictator. But what we're doing is we're breeding, we're sowing the seeds of further unrest and uprising and revolution and anti-American sentiment. And, you know, if you do the calculus, that ill will has a cost too. So that ill will and that aggression that people show towards America and that resistance to America, that has a cost too. That's a little bit more tricky to calculate, but I don't think anybody could argue that it has an adverse effect on our ability to project American values around the world. And when I say American values, I mean traditional, you know, as enshrined in the Constitution, American values.
Gotcha. You're not talking about, you know, what Tucker Carlson would call an American value, or Hannity, Strom Thurmond. I don't know why that might.
You're just showing your age now. No, listen, there are a lot of terms that are very elastic and malleable, like Christianity, right? That could mean a million different things to a million different people. American, the adjective American, that could mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I get that. What I usually refer back to and default to is, you know, the values that are enshrined in our founding documents. So you look at the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And again, you know me, I'm sort of like a jack of all trades and a master of none. I'm not a constitutional scholar. I just know that the values that were enshrined in the Constitution dealt with equality and fairness and justice and fair treatment for people and people's ability to express themselves politically without being oppressed. Those values are American values, and I only say that because they're enshrined right in our founding documents. And if we support dictators, and if we indiscriminately bomb civilians, we're undermining our ability. We're not only acting contrary to our enshrined values, we're undermining our ability in the future to do things that are positive for America and the world.
Right. Very pragmatic, Surf William. Very pragmatic. Surf William here, our resident historian on Troubadours and Rock On Tours, also plays the fiddle. He's a high school teacher, and he knows axes, I'll tell you. He has a little YouTube thing.
So much going on. But you know what? You should never be bored. If you're bored, you're boring. That's what I say.
Right. I always say the same thing. I wonder if we both came up with that together when we were teens hanging out in the woods.
Well, we weren't mutually brilliant, so, you know. There's that.
At least in our minds.
Mr. Rounds would be proud of us right now. Maybe.
He would.
Maybe.
He would.
He got in some Facebook tiffs over the years, too.
He's a little conservative.
He's a little conservative. Yeah, he is.
Yeah. Mr. Rounds, folks, is one of our high school teachers. So the Surf and I have known each other since 10th grade, I think, right? 10th grade, 9th grade?
Yeah, 10th grade.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock On Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest. Yeah. So, you know, you're our resident historian. I want you to put on your general's hat right now, too. I mean, What do you think this is going to end up, what's going on in the Ukraine right now?
God, I don't know, because Putin still has a lot of cards to play. So I'll be honest with you. Normally, and I've discussed some of this in my classes, too, in school. And I told my students, I apologized right up front. And I said, normally when we're talking about foreign policy and international affairs, I have my take on things. And I can provide some historical context. And I can talk to my students about financial interests and the way government operates and government's objectives and the things it's trying to achieve. And I can usually explain foreign policy decisions pretty well. But I gotta say, Putin's got me completely flummoxed right now. I don't know what his end game is. I don't know what his ultimate objective is. I don't know what he expected when he invaded Ukraine, what he thought the Ukrainian response would be, and what the world's response would be. So, you know, I guess I just don't have enough information. I'm completely bewildered by that. I thought he was going to threaten military action, get some things he wanted, and then sort of just hold that thing over the West's head like the sword of Damocles. But it seems so foolhardy what he's doing. I don't have a really good explanation, and I'll be honest with you, from what I've heard so far from analysts, nobody really seems to have a real good idea of what this guy's trying to do exactly, other than expand the traditional Russian empire, which kind of seems a little silly. Whatever Ukraine has that he wants, he could have purchased a lot cheaper than the cost of an invasion.
Right, and I think it has to do with his sense of age and legacy. You know, it's very much an indicator to me that he's being incredibly selfish, and he's being driven by these impulses of, you know, that are informed by a sense of grandeur. You know, he's dangerous even more so because he's not being pragmatic. And someone's there in Russia, and the oligarchs, for their own personal interests and their economic interests, I think they will be compelled to step in at some point.
I guess you know? So. Again, I don't think I understand modern Russia like very well, because I don't know how much influence the oligarchs have over Putin. Maybe his generals are more of a threat. Maybe his generals are the ones that will say, you know, we can't keep doing this. This is untenable, and something has to change. And if it means our leadership has to change, then so be it. Here's the thing. I have a good grasp of the history of Russia and Ukraine. And it's an ugly, ugly, ugly history. I just don't know what Putin's thinking right now. And, you know, and I don't feel bad about saying that, because I hear a lot of political pundits. They're confused, too.
So who are some of your favorite Russian thinkers?
Oh, Well, here's the thing. I don't have a favorite Russian thinker, but there are a lot of Russian journalists right now doing excellent work in Russia and in Ukraine, and several of them have already been killed in combat. So, you know, again, I wish I could answer your question, but I'm going to skirt that question. I'm going to answer a question that you didn't even ask.
Cool.
I'm going to say that a free press is the best tool we have against lies and oppression. And the first thing you see dishonest leaders do is undermine the credibility of the free press, restrict free speech, and flat out kill journalists who are reporting information that they don't want reported. And I'm looking at Donald Trump right now, and I'm saying, when you hear things like fake news and by the way, Lügenpresse is a German term that the Nazis originated, and it means the lying press. And what Trump was doing was a playbook right out of Goebbels' playbook. You know, they didn't like the news that was being reported, so that was lies. Or that was fake. Or that was un-American or un-German. So, you know, watch out, because Putin does the same things. Journalists have been killed all over Eastern Europe. Some, I think, at the direct instruction of Putin, because they're reporting on things that Putin doesn't want made public. So,
and yeah, exactly.
I skirted your question.
No,
because,
no, you didn't. That's good. I like where you went with it.
Let's talk about Solzhenitsyn, right?
Again, that's my favorite.
Yeah, I'm not an expert, but again, there was a voice of dissent in Russia. You know, Russia
put in the gulags.
Yeah, they have a long history of great thinkers, Dostoevsky, Solzhenitsyn, Tolstoy. They have a great Russia has a history of great Russian thinkers, and oftentimes their thinking goes against policy, and some of them have paid the price for that, like Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah, he ended up in Vermont.
Right?
Yeah,
he worse than that.
No, that's beautiful, actually. Now, we're just about done this go-around, Sir William. Let's end it with your reflections, or maybe even a message, assuming someone who is really affected, that's connected to the Ukraine. What would you say about and to the people and the leadership of the Ukraine?
What would I say to them?
Yeah. And about them.
I feel so guilty. I feel so guilty because I can't imagine what it's like to be leading your life and doing your best to get by and then have this kind of violence thrust upon you, this kind of unimaginable destruction and violence. You know, Ukraine has my support. I've already supported the Ukrainian cause and the cause of Ukrainian refugees financially. I've been bringing this issue into my classroom for all of my classes, so we can talk about it and be more aware of it and maybe take some action. I have, like I said, I've contributed some money to some charities, and I'm learning a lot more about what's going on with Ukrainian refugees being accepted into Germany right now. I think right at this point, we're over 100,000 in Germany. So, you know, I'm trying to raise awareness, and I would let anybody in Ukraine know that, you know, we stand with them 100%. Our government stands with them and our people stand with them, except a certain portion of our population who love Putin, who happen to also love Trump, who are anti-Zelensky, who are also pro-Trump. So, you know, you're always going to have traitors in your midst, and you're always going to have misinformed people who, you know, support the dictator. But the Ukrainians need to know that the vast majority of Americans in the world are on their side. I think that's clear.
Well said. Serf William, our resident historian here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Is that it? We're done?
Yeah, that's it, man.
It's always a little sad.
We'll be talking again.
I just want to say, before we go, one last thing. People need to learn, you know, go out and do a little bit of research. A fun way to learn history, and again, it doesn't make anybody an expert, but a fun way to learn history is to go to YouTube and just pop up some videos. The history of Ukraine, the history of Ukraine and Russia. Vet your sources, of course, but you're going to learn a lot about the history of the people who live in the area we call Ukraine and the oppression these people have faced and the terror these people have faced over the last 125 years. And it will give you a lot more, it will inform your ideas about Ukraine a lot more. You'll have a much better understanding of what they have endured over the last, you know, 100 to 125 years. And that's important, too.
Excellent. Thank you for that suggestion. I appreciate it. And I appreciate talking with you. Take care. Enjoy spring. And hopefully we'll see you soon.
I'll see you soon. I'll get up there for a visit.
Beautiful.
Okay. Much love.
Ciao, Fratello.
Ciao.
Sanctify, sanctify, sanctify your soul. Sanctify. Amen. I've got the devil in me.
Now, an excerpt from Franz Kafka's Investigations of a Dog. But it began with that concert. I do not blame the concert. It is my innate disposition that has driven me on, and it would certainly have found some other opportunity of coming into action had the concert never taken place. Yet the fact that it happened so soon used to make me feel sorry for myself. It robbed me of a great part of my childhood, the blissful life of the young dog, which many can spin out for years, in my case lasted for only a few short months. So be it. There are more important things than childhood, and perhaps I have the prospect of far more childlike happiness earned by a life of hard work in my old age than any actual child would have the strength to bear, but which then I shall possess. I began my inquiries with the simplest things. There was no lack of material. It is the actual superabundance, unfortunately, that casts me into despair in my darker hours. I began to inquire into the question what the canine race nourished itself upon. Now that is, if you like, by no means a simple question, of course. It has occupied us since the dawn of time. It is the chief object of all our meditation. Countless observations and essays and views on this subject have been published. It has grown into a province of knowledge which in its prodigious compass is not only beyond the comprehension of any single scholar, but of all our scholars collectively. A burden which cannot be borne except by the whole of the dog community, and even then with difficulty and not quite in its totality, for it ever and again crumbles away like a neglected ancestral inheritance and must laboriously be rehabilitated anew, not to speak at all of the difficulties and almost unfulfillable conditions of my investigation. No one need point all this out to me. I know it all as well as any average dog. I have no ambition to meddle with real scientific matters. I have all the respect for knowledge that it deserves. But to increase knowledge, I lack the equipment, the diligence, the leisure, and not least, and particularly during the past few years, the desire as well. I swallow down my food, but the slightest preliminary methodical, politico-economical observation of it does not seem to me worthwhile. In this connection, the essence of all knowledge is enough for me. The simple rule with which the mother weans her young ones from her teats and sends them out into the world. Water the ground as much as you can. And in the sentence, is not almost everything contained? What has scientific inquiry, ever since our first fathers inaugurated it, of decisive importance to add to this? Mere details, and how uncertain they are. But this rule will remain as long as we are dogs.
Sitting in the bathtub, counting my toes when the radiator broke. Water all froze, I got stuck in the ice. without my clothes, naked as the eyes of a clown. I was crying ice cubes, hoping I'd croak when the sun come through the window. The ice all broke, I stood up and laughed, thought it was a joke. That's the way that the world goes round. That's the way that the world goes round. You're up one day, the next you're down. It's a happening that you're water and you think you're gonna drown. That's the way that the world goes round. One day, the next you're down. It's a heaven and you're water and you think you're gonna drown. That's the way that the world goes round. That's the way that the world goes round. That's the way that the world goes round.
Despite the manicure. Yellow lamp light today in the early phase of spring, and we sing voluptuous in our heart. It is a shared experience, whether you believe it or not. All is teeming with the gravity of this constant earth spin. As the sun rules us in brightness, hair grows white and curls out of my chin every day and every night, despite the fog outside dissipating enchanted into the warm, wistful wind.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye, yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. Well, you know you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday will
I'll be through.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, when Cupid shot his dart, he shot it at your heart. So if we ever part, then I leave you. You sit and hold me and you tell me boldly that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye, yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day.
And there you have it, episode 465 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Serf William, Franz Kafka, and these musical artists: Thelonious Monk, Carl Perkins, Arrested Development, Zucchero, John Prine, Buddy Holly, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. And of course, I would like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care of yourself and others, too.